Good evening. Thank you for coming. When states enter the U.S., what happens? Do they become perpetual members, or can they withdraw at will? And what should be the response of the federal government to states that secede? In 1861, Abraham Lincoln was faced with this important constitutional question. An answer was needed, because a decision not to do anything was a decision to allow secession. Tonight, Dr. Glenn LaFantasy will discuss how Lincoln handled and faced this issue. This lecture is part of the traveling exhibition, Lincoln, the Constitution and the Civil War, which if you have not toured already, I invite you to look at after the lecture. The exhibition was sponsored by the National Constitution Center, the American Library Association, and was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Tonight, we have Dr. Glenn LaFantasy, the Richard Frock Family Professor of Civil War History and Director of the Institute for Civil War Studies here at WKU. Dr. LaFantasy received his PhD in history from Brown University and has written several books, including one of tonight's door prizes, Twilight at Little Round Top, which is about the battle at Gettysburg. Gettysburg Requiem, The Life and Lost Cause of Confederate Colonel William C. Oates, and Gettysburg Heroes, Perfect Soldiers, Hallowed Ground. He's currently working on two books, Lincoln and Grant, which will examine the relationship between the Union Commander-in-Chief and his most successful general, and Past Meets Present, How the Civil War Endures in American Life. He's also a contributing writer on history and politics for Salon.com. So now let me turn it over to Dr. LaFantasy.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful to all of you who obviously received my check in the mail and showed up. So it worked. Seriously, I'm very appreciative of your coming out this evening. A little chilly out there to hear me talk about Abraham Lincoln, one of my latest favorite subjects other than Ulysses S. Grant, I suppose. So I've moved on from Gettysburg. I'd like to point out a little something about this door prize. It may be worth far more than you realize if you should win this or if you have a copy of this paperback edition, because the very first page has a description of the author. And let me read to you the final sentence in this description. He lives with his wife in Bowling Green, Virginia. Which I got to tell you, it's a heck of a commute every morning over those mountains and back again. It's rough, but that's what I do. So that little misprint, I consider it to be a mark of a collector's edition. I don't know if they're ever going to correct that, actually. I pointed out to them, but that's the way it goes. Well, Brian raised the key issues that Lincoln faced when he was elected in November 1860, and then had to wait a very long time, longer than presidents-elect have to wait nowadays. He had to wait until the first week of March to be inaugurated. Now we inaugurate at the end of January. So it was an excruciatingly long period of time that Lincoln and presidents of that era had to wait. But Lincoln's wait was all the worse because he was facing a crisis, inherited a crisis of monumental proportions. Probably the deepest and gravest crisis that any president has faced. So he spent those months, as I'll relate, trying to figure out for himself exactly what he was going to do. And I suppose Lincoln can be forgiven for thinking that the Southern states wouldn't secede from the Union after his election to the presidency, since Southerners had been threatening disunion for at least a decade without actually making any serious attempt to separate themselves from the old republic. Northerners, like Lincoln, regarded Southern secession rhetoric as a subterfuge, a ruse to squeeze the North into making permanent political concessions to protect and perpetuate the institution of slavery. After visiting Lincoln in Springfield during the interregnum between the election and Inauguration Day, Don Piatt, an Ohio diplomat and writer, lamented that the president-elect underestimated the secession threat by believing that Southerners were playing a sort of political game of bluff, gotten up by politicians and meant solely to frighten the North. Lincoln, said Piatt, also thought that when the Southern leaders saw that their efforts in that direction were unavailing, the tumult would subside. At the same time, Henry Adams, the grandson and great-grandson of two presidents, famously called the long hiatus between Lincoln's election and his inauguration the Great Secession Winter. And he criticized the president for failing to declare his position on the question of secession and for neglecting to channel the Republican Party toward specific goals of acquiescence, compromise, or resistance to disunion. In an essay written during the winter of crisis, but not published until the 20th century, Adams described how Republicans who confronted a quandary over policy as the country fell apart turned for the decisive word to the final authority in Springfield, that is Lincoln, the new head of the party. But the word did not come. Instead, said Adams, the Republican Party was left to ponder doubtful rumors tending to distract public opinion still more. Worse, insisted Adams, there was no concerted action between the president-elect and the Republicans at Washington, which, in Adams's estimation, left only one man, William H. Seward, to formulate a policy of reconciliation that might avert the rising tide of secession as the winter months elapsed. While we know now that Adams was wrong about Lincoln's inactivity, that indeed the president-elect communicated rather multitudinously with Republican leaders in person and in private to express his political desires that winter, Adams' central point about Lincoln's failure to initiate concerted action has kept its sting, if only because the man in Springfield approached the secession crisis by so often saying one thing and then doing another. Take, for instance, Lincoln's decision to remain silent on the key issues facing the country until his inauguration in Washington. For the entire campaign leading up to his election, he had followed the prevailing political tradition by not making public declarations or actively campaigning for himself. His fellow Republicans warned him not to sully himself in the political arena. William Cullen Bryant, the influential editor of the New York Evening Post, told Lincoln that the vast majority of your friends hoped that the candidate would make no speeches, write no letters, enter into no pledges, make no promises, nor even give any of those kind words which men are apt to interpret into promises. Lincoln took this advice to heart. While Henry Villard of the New York Herald submitted almost daily reports on Lincoln's activity in Springfield after the Election Day celebrations had died down, emphasizing that the president-elect would not make any policy statements until the proper time shall arrive. Lincoln actually began to let his fellow Republicans know precisely what he was thinking and feeling about the mounting national crisis. In fact, the idea that Lincoln remained silent as the secession crisis played out over the winter of 1860 to 1861 is something of a myth, although Lincoln biographers and other historians persist in claiming that Lincoln kept his own counsel during these long, politically agonizing months. What actually is the case is what anyone who has studied Lincoln's life might readily expect. During the months between his election and inauguration, Lincoln wrote and spoke frequently about where he stood politically and the course he wished his fellow Republicans in Washington to follow. Lincoln did not pursue what Illinois Congressman Elihu B. Washburn called a masterly inactivity during those months. True to his character, Lincoln could not remain inactive and silent while he waited for his inauguration to occur. The evidence is abundant, in fact, that he succumbed to public and party pressure to reassure Southerners of his intentions when he occupied the White House and to manipulate the outcome of congressional efforts to deal with the twin issues of secession and slavery. Indeed, Lincoln was hardly the shut-mouthed man that his law partner, William Herndon, believed him to be. While it is true that Lincoln could often be secret and reticent, as Herndon had claimed, hiding his private self from the view not only of the wider public, but even from his friends and family, he spent weeks after his election talking, writing, and listening, sometimes openly in public, sometimes confidentially in private communications, but he was by no means silent. Even before his election, Lincoln worried about the fate of the federal property in the South if any states in that region decided to turn their threats into action and leave the Union. He received a recommended course of action from Winfield Scott, General-in-Chief of the U.S. Army, and later thanked him for the advice. In late December 1860, after South Carolina had seceded, Lincoln asked Congressman Washburn to instruct Scott to be as well prepared as he can to either hold or retake the forts in Charleston Harbor, either before or after the inauguration. Meanwhile, Lincoln had established his campaign headquarters in the governor's reception room of the Illinois State Capitol, where after his election, he continued to receive mountains of letters, most of which offered congratulations and went unanswered, and a practically endless stream of visitors who wanted to pay their respects and see precisely what this new president-elect looked like. Without fail, for 2 hours in the morning and two in the afternoon, he spoke to everyone who came to see him, often declaring to strangers and reporters alike, "Well, boys, your troubles are over now, but mine have just commenced." He spoke mostly in platitudes. Villard, reporting for the New York Herald, said that Lincoln was more listened to than talked to, but that what he had to say was not brilliant. Often Lincoln filled his chatter with jokes and witticisms of one sort or another, some of them crude and even vulgar. Some biographers have concluded that Lincoln told jokes to avoid saying anything of substance to his visitors and artfully dodged pronouncements about the South and slavery, but he played the press mercilessly by speaking on the record and using those newspaper reports to court public favor. Even so, Lincoln probably was not as nimble in manipulating the press as some historians, such as Harold Holzer and Doris Kearns Goodwin, have suggested. To a great extent, Lincoln talked so much during the months after election, including on-the-record interviews he granted to journalists, simply because he liked to tell stories, a talent he had picked up from his father, Thomas Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln may not have been as occasionally, Lincoln may have been as occasionally shut-mouthed or even morose as Herndon and other people close to him observed, but he was also gregarious and loquacious. Often it was hard to keep Lincoln from talking and talking and talking. Nor were his comments all quips or fluff. One newspaper correspondent reported that Lincoln received his visitors with winning affability, converses freely upon political topics, and does not hesitate to express his opinions thereon. Privately, Lincoln answered the fairly desperate pleas of fellow Republicans who wanted to know that he would not change his position on the extension of slavery into the territories and would refuse to compromise with Southern extremists over the issue of secession. On November 8th, Henry S. Sanford, a former diplomat in the Taylor administration, hand-delivered a letter from Truman Smith, a Republican attorney from New York, who looked for reassurances from Lincoln and expressed his belief that the president-elect should say something publicly to allay causeless anxiety, to compose the public mind, and to induce all good citizens to determine now, as they have uniformly in the past, that they will judge the tree by its fruit. 2 days later, Lincoln answered Smith by saying that he felt constrained for the present, at least to make no declaration for the public. In what would become a mantra for Lincoln over the coming weeks, he declared to Smith that I could say nothing which I have not already said and which is in print and open for the inspection of all. To press a repetition of this upon those who have listened is useless. To press it upon those who have refused to listen and still refuse would be wanting in self-respect and would have the appearance of sycophancy and timidity, which would excite the contempt of good men and encourage bad ones to clamor more loudly. Here then was Lincoln's first miscalculation during the growing secession crisis. How he could make such a statement to Smith should seem remarkable and give us pause, although historians have generally praised this letter for demonstrating the president-elect's determination to keep his silence until he could say something only as president. But what was Lincoln thinking? To be sure, his earlier public statements that articulated his emphatic opposition to the expansion of slavery into the Western territories were well known. And it was also true that Lincoln had not changed his stand on slavery. But during the 6 years leading up to his election, Lincoln had also warned the country, famously and somewhat recklessly, that a house divided against itself cannot stand, adding, in fact, his belief that this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. Worse still, he had not simply spoken those words when he delivered his famous House Divided speech in Springfield on June 16, 1858. Actually, Lincoln had repeated the same words over and over in two other speeches given in July of that year. If that were not enough, he knew just how controversial his House Divided pronouncement had been, for his scriptural paraphrase became a searing point of contention during his famous debates with Illinois Senator Stephen A. Douglas later that summer in 1858. His words gave no comfort at the time to Southerners. Indeed, it confirmed their worst fears about Lincoln, that he intended to eradicate slavery where it already existed rather than simply keep it out of the territories. Without recognizing the incendiary nature of what he had already said in public, he freely, and one must say rather fatuously, handed nearly every one of his visitors a pamphlet edition of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, if only to make sure that they would read his references to a house divided. No doubt he was right that his detractors had heard what they wanted to hear in his most forceful speeches after the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854, and that they would want to cast him to perdition no matter what he said, either before or after his election. But he never really grasped that the political sands were shifting under his feet. Before Election Day, the most pressing issue of the day had been the institution of slavery, its extension to the West, and its fate in the southern states where it had existed before the Compromise of 1850. But in the weeks following his election, the issue of secession loomed ominously over the land, like a cloud blotting out the slavery debates that had spawned it. In his public remarks after 1854, Lincoln alluded from time to time to the bugbear of disunion, but he dismissed the threat of secession with contempt, for he believed the South was merely bluffing. Unfortunately, that is also what he continued to think into the weeks following his election, which meant that he could not readily detect just how momentously the sands were shifting or how his elevation to the presidency had changed everything, including the South's determination to resist accepting a black Republican as its chief executive, even though members of his own party and moderate Southerners recognized trouble on the horizon and tried to advise him that a storm was about to explode below the Mason-Dixon line. Lincoln simply could not believe that that storm was coming. On November 13th, Elihu Washburn paid Lincoln a visit and reported that Lincoln was in fine spirits and excellent health and quite undisturbed by the blustering of Unionists and traitors. But it was becoming more and more difficult for the president-elect to ignore the events and ignore how those events, in so short a time, were overtaking him, stirring in him a need to say something even while he played the stoic. 2 days after Washburn's visit, Lincoln told some well-wishers who had stopped by the governor's reception room, "My own impression is, at present," leaving myself room to modify the opinion if upon further investigation, I should see fit to do so. Gosh, he sounds like a politician, doesn't he? "That this government possesses both the authority and the power to maintain its own integrity. That, however, is not the ugly point of this matter. The ugly point is the necessity of keeping the government together by force, as ours should be a government of fraternity." But he still suffered from some blind spots. Around the same time, he told another visitor that he didn't know of any speech in which William H. Seward, Lincoln's likely choice for Secretary of State in his cabinet, had ever spoken menacingly of the South. How could Lincoln not know and remember Seward's two famous speeches, the Higher Law speech of 1850 and his Irrepressible Conflict speech of 1858, both of which caused Southerners to regard Seward as a menace to slavery, who was willing to wage war to do away with it? Astonishingly, Lincoln also said that so far as he knew, not only a single prominent public Republican had justly made obnoxious words to the South by anything he had said or done, and that they had only become so because the Southern politicians had so persistently bespotted and bespattered every Northern man by their misrepresentations to rob them of what strength they might otherwise have. Lincoln is often cast as not an ideologue, but one can hear some echoes, certainly, of the partisan split between Northerners and Southerners in Lincoln's remarks at this time. Either Lincoln was being disingenuous, or he thought he'd try some hard political talk for a change. In any event, his usual instincts for pragmatic politics began to fail him. Not only was he breaking the tradition of presidents-elect maintaining silence before their inauguration, but he was also saying things, although admittedly to a tiny number of people, that could potentially alienate the South even more, damage his credibility, and potentially blow up in his face down the road. In public, he claimed that he could not really comment on the country's circumstances because, he said, his election would not be official until the Electoral College met on December 5th, 1860, or the electoral votes were counted on February 13th, 1861. Privately, he claimed not to be at liberty to shift my ground, insisting that to do so was out of the question. Then he did just that and executed a complete about-face, writing a passage for Illinois Senator Lyman Trumbull to include in a speech in Springfield on November 20th that was aimed at accomplishing what Lincoln had asserted only days earlier as being out of the question, namely a statement to reassure Southerners of his good intentions. The statement, dutifully read by Trumbull, declared in part, "I have labored in and for the Republican organization with entire confidence that whenever it shall be in power, each and all of the states will be left in as complete control of their own affairs respectively, and at as perfect liberty to choose and employ their own means of protecting property and preserving peace and order within their respective limits as they have ever been under any administration. Those who have voted for Mr. Lincoln have expected and still expect this," he said, referring to himself in the third person, and they would not have voted for him had they expected otherwise. "I regard it as extremely fortunate for the peace of the whole country that this point upon which the Republicans have been so long and so persistently misrepresented is now to be brought to a practical test and placed beyond the possibility of doubt. Despite the confusion caused by the use of both the first-person pronoun and third-person reference to Lincoln's name within the statement, those people who read or heard Trumbull's remarks understood that this passage came from the president-elect himself, not from the senator. In some other passages, Trumbull changed Lincoln's words or added others, but he felt confident about not having tampered with Lincoln's meaning. Wisely, however, Trumbull left out of his speech an entire paragraph that Lincoln wanted him to insert. It's a bizarre comment that reveals how muddle-headed Lincoln had become during the fortnight after his election. Lincoln wanted Trumbull to say for him, "I am rather glad of this military preparation in the South. It will enable the people more easily to suppress any uprisings there, which their misrepresentations of purposes may have encouraged." Later that night, a crowd assembled in front of Lincoln's house. Always reluctant to speak without prepared remarks, Lincoln nevertheless addressed his cheering neighbors with conciliatory language and asked his listeners to remember, while they rejoiced in the recent Republican victory on election night, not to express or cherish any harsh feeling towards any citizen who by his vote has differed with us. Let us at all times remember that all American citizens are brothers of a common country and should dwell together in bonds of fraternal feeling. For someone who had already gained a reputation as a political pragmatist, someone who responded to political matters by using common sense and judging each situation or issue with a critical empiricism rather than by assessments based on ideology, Lincoln seemed in the weeks just following his election to be awash at sea. His pragmatism had led him to slippery slopes of saying one thing at one moment, another thing soon after, and then back to his original proposition, like a ship being tossed, bobbing one way and then the other on stormy waters. By the end of November, Lincoln learned that his statement delivered by Trumbull either had been ignored by the press or had been misconstrued. He complained to Henry Raymond, the editor of the New York Times, that Northern newspapers had failed to use the speech to quiet public anxiety. Instead, the press had endeavored to inflame the North with the belief that it foreshadows an abandonment of Republican ground by the incoming administration. As a result, Lincoln convinced himself, at least for the time being, that the Trumbull comments proved that he should remain silent and he could not utter a single word without it being misinterpreted, which is an early version of "it's the media's fault." It did not occur to him, however, that his statement might have been poorly constructed, especially that portion of it that did some partisan hammering by accusing Southerners and others of persistently misrepresenting Republican political policies. There's no evidence that Lincoln thanked Trumbull for removing the paragraph from his statement dealing with the South's military preparations, which was another striking example of the president-elect's political clumsiness, but he owed a huge debt to the Illinois senator for saving him from causing any more confusion on the national political scene than he had already accomplished, both publicly and privately. What the month of November initiated for Lincoln was an extensive period of vacillation and missteps unlike any other in his political career, either before his election or after the firing on Fort Sumter nearly 4.5 months later. The American pragmatic tradition is a noble one, extending back at least as far as the bumptious colonial assemblies who thwarted royal governors and executive authority with a boldness that transformed situational politics into a high art. At the very least, the pragmatic tradition in Lincoln's time owed much to the founders, who, when their declared independence from Great Britain was in jeopardy, they turned to France for assistance, and who, when their loose confederation of states no longer served the purpose of republicanism with a small r, concocted a constitution that both embodied and violated the principles of republicanism for the sake of a federal union. Needless to say, Lincoln venerated the founders and their pragmatic blueprints for the Republic, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, and he missed no opportunity to wax eloquent when it came to praising the founding fathers and their brilliant accomplishments. But Lincoln was no born-again child of the Enlightenment. Instead, he represented a melding of Enlightenment ideas, such as a belief in natural rights and equality of opportunity, with a more rugged political approach based on frontier pragmatism. To a great extent, Lincoln combined in his political thinking the unionism of George Washington, the enlightened ideals of Thomas Jefferson, the Whig nationalism of Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, and a pragmatism that seemed to contain more than a glimmer of what Frederick Jackson Turner, the historian, would later describe as constituting the essence of American exceptionalism. The American character, said Turner in his famous essay that has now been so thoroughly discredited by historians that they no longer take it into account, the American character owed its traits to the Western frontier. That coarseness of strength, combined with acuteness and inquisitiveness, that practical, inventive turn of mind, quick to find expedients, that masterful grasp of material things, lacking in the artistic but powerful to effect great ends, that restless, nervous energy, that dominant individualism working for good and for evil, and with all that buoyancy and exuberance which comes with freedom, these are the traits of the frontier, or traits called out elsewhere because of the existence of the frontier. Before Turner could attribute these traits to American pioneers, and thus to American identity as a whole, the Reverend Matthew Simpson ascribed them to Lincoln in a funeral sermon for the 16th president. His home was the growing West, the heart of the Republic, and invigorated by the wind which swept over its prairies, he learned lessons of self-reliance which sustained him in seasons of adversity. The pragmatism in politics, as Lincoln demonstrated so awkwardly during the Great Secession winter, is not always a virtue and does not, in every circumstance, offer the practitioner a solid platform upon which to stand. Indeed, Lincoln's pragmatic approach to the crisis brewing in the South made him look hesitant, indecisive, equivocating, hardly the posture that a president-elect wants to assume as the late nation looks to him for reassurance. Surely Lincoln's attitude was the same as it would later be during his presidency when he said so famously, "My policy is to have no policy, and I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me." But in the fall of 1860, as in the winter and spring of 1861, his critics ardently complained of Lincoln's inability to say what he intended to do, and they keenly noticed that he tended to drift rather than take the wheel. They feared, in fact, that he was a man of his word, that indeed he had no policy. Later, regarding the reconstruction of the southern states, he explained to James G. Blaine, a Maine congressman, that the pilots of our western rivers steer from point to point, as they call it, setting the course of the boat no farther than they can see. And that is all I propose to myself in this great problem. In other words, he was going to go down the Mississippi River. His administration would be like a raft going down the Mississippi River and piloting the vessel from one snag to the, avoiding one snag to another. But that Lincoln would have to wait to blossom. In December 1860, he wavered and faltered like, one might say, a duck hit on the head, which is how he described William Rosecrans after the Battle of Chickamauga. Early in the month, he publicly commented, breaking his supposed cone of silence, on President James Buchanan's annual address to Congress. The president-elect, reported Henry Villard for the New York Herald, very freely gave vent to his surprise at its tenor, as it plainly revealed, in his opinion, Mr. Buchanan's desire to wrest the whole responsibility of the secession movement on the free states. Meanwhile, more quietly, Lincoln advised Republican Congressman William Pitt Kellogg of Illinois to entertain no compromise in regard to the extension of slavery. The instant you do, they have us under again. All our labor is lost, and sooner or later must be done over. The tug has to come, and better now than later. Lincoln was worried about the effort in Congress, prompted by Buchanan's address, to find a compromise solution to the impending secession crisis. Eventually, the House of Representatives created a special committee of 33, and the Senate established a committee of 13 to hammer out a compromise. Don't you feel like this is deja vu all over again? Isn't it great? In the heat of the moment, Lincoln bristled at the mounting threats of secession from some Southerners. The South, he said to Villard, has eyes but does not see, and ears but does not hear. Yet at the same time, he informed a Philadelphia newspaper correspondent, I think from all I can learn that things have reached their worst point in the South, and they are likely to mend in the future. If South Carolina did leave the Union, Lincoln, speaking at length, said that the greatest difficulty would be in collecting revenues and maintaining federal courts. Yeah, he wished that those were going to be the only problems. His tone and language were moderate, good-humored, and friendly toward the South, asserted one reporter. But Lincoln took the political opportunity to needle the South. He said that the charges made by the South against the North were so indefinite that they could not be regarded as sound. The reporter noted that Lincoln showed no caution in keeping his remarks private, and as he knew my professional position and yet gave no such caution, there can be no violation of confidence in publishing this very brief, actually quite lengthy, sketch of his remarks. In other words, Lincoln failed to go off the record, if in fact he failed at all. He may have intentionally made these remarks to the reporter. In other words, the Philadelphia correspondent thought Lincoln was being indiscreet. The president-elect, however, did tell the reporter that his view of the situation in the South could change in light of the progress of events. That's pragmatism at work again. Increasingly worried that the Republican Party would sell itself out, Lincoln warned Elihu Washburne to avoid the prospect of compromise on the extension of slavery and hold firm as with a chain of steel. As circumstances grew worse and reports arrived in Springfield from Western merchants being mobbed by Southerners, Lincoln contemplated the formation of his cabinet and, despite his no-compromise doctrine, decided to include some prominent Southerners among his advisors. To be sure, he was thinking about moderate Southerners like Alexander H. Stephens of Georgia and John A. Gilmer of North Carolina. The president-elect revealed that he had no idea how the secessionist movement was gaining ground like a wildfire, and how Southerners themselves were ready to stand strong like a chain of steel. By the middle of December, however, Lincoln had reversed himself. He explained to Frank Blair, Sr. of Missouri, that he could hardly maintain his self-respect if he appointed one of his Southern opponents to his cabinet, adding that he considered such a course an admission that the Republican Party was incapable of governing the country and would be a rebuke by him to those who had voted for him. Lincoln's pragmatism was commendable, but even now looking back over the past 150 years, it's hard not to conclude that he was truly adrift at sea. On December 18th, Senator John J. Crittenden of Kentucky introduced his famous compromise, which included six separate unamendable constitutional amendments to appease North and South for consideration by Congress. The Crittenden Compromise was tabled on December 31st. Naturally, Lincoln opposed the compromise, but he toyed with the idea of supporting New Mexico's admission as a slave state in return for Kansas coming into the Union as a free state, which was, all things considered, his most blatant inconsistency yet, since it came at a time when he was urging his fellow Republicans not to budge on the issue of slavery. Confidently, he told Thurlow Weed, the New York Republican boss and Seward's closest advisor, that while there are some loud threats and much muttering in the cotton states, he hoped that by wisdom and forbearance, the danger of serious trouble might be averted, as such dangers had been in former times. Then, when it seemed like nothing else could possibly go wrong, word arrived in Springfield that South Carolina had officially seceded. Astonishingly, Lincoln seemed nonplussed by the news. Henry Willard of the Herald, is to be believed, the president-elect did not experience any extraordinary shock of nerves. Instead, Lincoln, probably at a loss for once in his life as to what to say, turned to a witticism to carry him through. He told Willard he would henceforth look for foreign inland news in his daily newspapers. But Lincoln did make plain that he would not bow to compromise just because of South Carolina's action. Privately, however, he hoped that William H. Seward would submit resolutions to Congress to strengthen the fugitive slave law, passed as part of the Compromise of 1850, by requiring northern states to rescind any personal liberty laws that they enacted. Those personal liberty laws were means by which northern states, in a sense, nullified the fugitive slave law of 1850. At the same time, he instructed Andrew G. Curtin, the governor-elect of Pennsylvania, that the Union must be maintained at all hazards. As he juggled the pressing political problem of his cabinet appointments, Lincoln worried more and more about the fate of federal property, including forts in Charleston and its vicinity. He instructed Frank Blair to let General Scott know that if the fort shall be given up before the inauguration, the general would have to use armed force to retake them afterwards. In case the message did not get through to Scott, Lincoln wanted Washburn to tell Scott to be as well prepared as he can to either hold or retake the forts, as the case may require, at and after the inauguration. The president-elect also worked effectively to block the Crittenden Compromise by alerting his fellow Republicans, mostly through private correspondence, of its dangers and enjoining them to defeat it. Much to his chagrin, Charles Francis Adams, a Republican congressman from Massachusetts, member of the House Committee of 33, blamed Lincoln for refusing to embrace any compromise proposal and believed that declarations coming almost openly from Mr. Lincoln have had the effect of perfectly consolidating the Republicans in their opposition to the compromise. Adams was a compromise man. He wanted to follow a path of reconciliation with the South. It could hardly be said that Lincoln operated entirely behind the scenes in getting what he wanted from his party, at least so far as the Crittenden Compromise was concerned. Lincoln may have shown no jitters to Willard over South Carolina's secession, and he may have also believed that he was upholding political tradition by not becoming involved in policy matters before his inauguration, but he was up to his formidable ears in issuing what can only be called an order to the General-in-Chief of the United States Army and laying the foundation for his later policy regarding secession during the immediate aftermath of the Palmetto States Act of Disunion. He still is only president-elect. He has not been inaugurated as yet. When he heard a rumor that Buchanan intended to give up the forts in and around Charleston Harbor, Lincoln exclaimed to his secretary, John Nicolay, "If that is true, they ought to hang him." To Alexander H. Stevens, congressman from Georgia, Lincoln expressed his mettle over the issue of slavery and implicitly over secession. "Do the people of the South really entertain fears that a Republican administration would directly or indirectly interfere with their slaves or with them about their slaves? If they do, I wish to assure you, as once a friend and still, I hope, not an enemy, that there is no cause for such fears. The South would be in no more danger in this respect than in the days of Washington. I suppose, however, this does not meet the case. You think slavery is right and ought to be extended, while we think it is wrong and ought to be restricted. That, I suppose, is the rub. It certainly is the only substantial difference between us." This is an odd comment to make when a state has left the Union. Remember, this is after South Carolina has seceded. For the rest of the month, Lincoln tried publicly to show resolve in the face of secession, although much of his attention was taken up with weighing his forthcoming cabinet appointments, a process that kept him wavering in another arena, especially when it came to deciding definitively whether or not to give Simon Cameron of Pennsylvania one of the key posts. By February, Lincoln outlandishly remarked that the upheaval over Cameron's appointment gave him more trouble than anything he had encountered as president-elect, including secession. Nevertheless, he does seem to have been aware that he mishandled the Cameron affair, and by first offering and later retracting the appointment, finally going through with the appointment after all, he made his life even more miserable than it had to be that winter. With the new year, Republican leaders in Congress became increasingly aware of and voiced their complaints about what Congressman George W. Julian of Indiana later described as Lincoln's overwrought tendency to effect a balancing of matters, which vexed Julian and other party members because it made the president look indecisive and dithering. Later still, Ward Hill Lehman, usually disregarded as a reliable source by historians, insightfully lamented that Lincoln had been slow to realize or to acknowledge, even to himself, the awful gravity of the situation and the danger that the gathering clouds portended. To the public, Lincoln continued to affirm his commitment to keep slavery out of the territories. He told an unfriendly Democratic newspaper, the Illinois State Register, that there could be no abandonment of this position by himself or by his party. But to his friends, including Joseph Gillespie of Illinois, Lincoln acknowledged that he faced pressures that he almost could not bear. "Every hour adds to the difficulties I am called upon to meet," he confided to Gillespie. "And the present administration does nothing to check this tendency toward dissolution." Lincoln was feeling sorry for himself. "I, who have been called to meet this awful responsibility, am compelled to remain here in Springfield, doing nothing to avert it or to lessen its force when it comes to me," he complained. The outlook, he said, was gloomy. "Secession is being fostered rather than repressed," he said. "And if the doctrine meets with general acceptance in the border states, it will be a great blow to the government." Yeah. What Lincoln revealed, I think, was that his chronic depression, as well as his political pragmatism, was playing a role in how he handled the crisis before him. Some of the classic symptoms of depression are the inability to concentrate, to make decisions, and to remember things, including what one may have said 2 weeks ago or even yesterday. I'm not arguing that Lincoln's wobbling was necessarily caused by forgetfulness. There's no clear evidence that such a thing took place during the secession winter. But I do maintain that Lincoln's lack of certitude and his wavering from one position to another was probably compounded by depression, what was more commonly called melancholia in the 19th century, and by his lifelong fatalism, what he called doctrine of necessity, that made him believe in almost Calvinistic fashion that, according to his friend and partner William H. Herndon, what was to be would be, and no prayers of ours could arrest or reverse the decree. In other words, his fatalism seemed to contain a very high dose of predestination, Calvinistic predestination. In that sense, then, men were mere tools in the hands of fate, were made as they are made by conditions and, of course, by events. This doctrine did not amount to an all-encompassing system of belief for Lincoln. It did not mean, for instance, that he completely remained passive as the secession winter played itself out. But what it might have done, along with Lincoln's pragmatic approach to politics and his struggle with melancholia, was to produce a lack of certitude in his thinking and a very hazy map of the path he should follow on the road to his inauguration. While Lincoln slipped into self-pity, focusing on a visit from Simon Cameron to Springfield and the mess he himself had created over the Pennsylvania politician's appointment to the cabinet, Mississippi, Florida, and Alabama left the Union. If he ever considered himself to be potentially facing the kind of crisis that Andrew Jackson confronted with South Carolina's nullification of the Tariff of Abomination, Lincoln must have now realized that the secession of four states, with a real possibility of more to follow, created far more complicated circumstances than Jackson ever had to deal with. For one thing, Lincoln was not yet in office. For another, he now had to worry about how he could protect federal citizens and federal property in states that no longer swore allegiance to the Union. In Washington, Seward caved in to the staggering realities of secession by suggesting that two new states be carved out of the Western territories and proposing a constitutional amendment to ensure the perpetuity of slavery in the states where it already existed. He even went so far as to recommend the calling of a national constitutional convention. Lincoln, in another of his odd moments, told Senator George G. Fogg of New Hampshire that he wasn't pleased with Seward's proposals, but to Seward himself, the president-elect wrote that the senator's recommendations had been well received in Springfield and that, in Lincoln's opinion, were doing good all over the country. It is possible, of course, for politicians to say one thing and think another, or to play things close to the vest whenever opportunity or advantage permits. And no doubt Lincoln frequently did so before and during his presidency. But the comment to Seward seems disingenuous, at the very least. If Lincoln didn't mean what he said to Seward, why say it at all? In fact, Lincoln, for the moment anyway, was supporting the idea of concessions to the South. John Hay, who was serving as another of Lincoln's secretaries, secretly reported in a dispatch to the Missouri Democrat, a Republican newspaper based in St. Louis, that he believed the president-elect coincides with Governor Seward in favoring a convention of people to suggest amendments to the Constitution. Hay thought that Lincoln would not make any such proposal until after his inauguration, but when once at the head of the nation, those who are laboring for peace with singleness of heart will never find their plans balked by any factious opposition from him. Lincoln even composed a set of resolutions for submission to the Illinois State Assembly to call for a national constitutional convention. Publicly, however, Lincoln stood his ground. He told a visitor, probably Congressman William Pitt Kellogg, "I will suffer death before I will consent or will advise my friends to consent to any concession or compromise which looks like buying the privilege of taking possession of this government to which we have a constitutional right." No matter what he might think of the merit of the various propositions before Congress, he said, "I should regard any concession in the face of menace, the destruction of the government itself." Notwithstanding his determination, he added that this thing will hereafter be as it is now, in the hands of the people. And if they desire to call a convention to remove any grievances complained of, or to give new guarantees for the permanence of vested rights, it is not mine to oppose. With considerably more firmness, Lincoln wrote to Seward, "I say now, however, as I have all the while said, that on the territorial question, that is the question of extending slavery under the national auspices, I am inflexible. I am for no compromise which assists or permits the extension of the institution on soil owned by the nation. And any trick by which the nation is to acquire territory and then allow some local authority to spread slavery over it is as obnoxious as any other." In the meantime, Georgia voted for secession on January 19th, and Louisiana left the Union on January 26th. By the time Lincoln was writing to Seward and confirming his resolve to resist compromise, Texas became the seventh state to secede. All of Lincoln's inconsistencies could very well have been purposeful on his part. Perhaps he was playing both ends against the middle, which one might argue was and still is a favorite tactic, even a national pastime for politicians. But the sheer volume of his inconsistencies suggests something more complicated than adroit political craftsmanship, or at the other extreme, simple equivocation. Given all the instances of vacillation throughout the interregnum period, I think Lincoln, and not just the nation, was experiencing a profound crisis, a personal crisis that tested him beyond anything he had confronted before. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that wonderful insight into the secession crisis. At this point, we do have time for questions.
Had the inauguration been in January, as it is today, would circumstances have altered his views? Or
I don't think so. I think, as I closed with the remark, that he was in a deep personal crisis, trying to figure out how best he should manage this. And a modern phrase for this is he was over his head. He was a local politician who had never succeeded in winning national office except one term as a U.S. congressman. And here he was faced with the proposition of states leaving the union and then have left the union with him having no executive experience whatsoever. I think, and I could have certainly expanded my interpretation to include that Lincoln's lack of experience hurt him in this great secession winter. I explained it so well.
What would you have had him done differently?
Well, if he was going to remain silent, he should have remained silent. that was one option. And that's what's misled historians, is that Lincoln said so often that he was remaining silent that he's convinced historians that he remained silent, when, in fact, as I began to stack up the evidence here, it was very clear he wasn't silent at all. And historians have tended to favor the fact that he seems to have participated in private correspondence as opposed to public pronouncements. But as I weighed those, there seemed to be a 50-50 divide between public and private expressions of whatever concern he had at the moment. And I don't mean to sound too harsh on him, which I suppose this paper does, but I'm hoping that, as Lincoln himself was a pragmatist, that my interpretation, if it has any credit, might be a pragmatic one, a realistic one, of what he was experiencing, what he really went through during those intervening months. He continued to vacillate in the White House to a considerable degree, as I see it, at least. I was hoping in my investigations that Fort Sumter would be the loud explosion that would wake him up. But even after Sumter, he vacillated a great deal. But he found himself as president. I just think it took a lot longer than most historians suggest and biographers suggest. I think Lincoln was at sea, to use that expression, for a good long time into his presidency. And it's not until 1862 or so that, in our modern expression, a light bulb goes off over his head. He gains clarity and he gains decisiveness as the war continues. He comes to see what it really means and what it's really all about. And I'm not sure he saw that in his period of being president-elect. I think he was lost to a great extent.
So are we saying, in a sense, that if Lincoln had kind of risen up on his back legs, the Civil War could have been avoided?
No, I don't think so. He could have risen up on his back legs and shown a great deal of backbone, but to no avail. I mean, those states had left the Union. And he believed at first that even if they left, they would come back, which partly explains his vacillation. It was a hope devoutly to be desired, but one that was never consummated. And it took time for him to realize that these people were serious. This was not just rhetoric. The South was going through with this, and all the evidence was there. The creation of a separate country was enough proof. In February, before he was inaugurated, there was a separate nation existing on the North American continent.
The remarks that you quoted about him talking about the people and
South Carolina, the federal people and the federal property needed to be preserved and protected. Did he think that secession was not a popular movement, that it was a legislative only?
Yeah. He believed, as many Northerners believed, that this was simply the expression of political extremists in the South, that if he could reach the public, most Southerners would show their affection for the Union and would not leave it. But he was wrong in that regard. He was right about the extent of Unionist sentiment in the South, which continued well through the Civil War, and with many those white Southerners who very reluctantly showed allegiance to the Confederate States of America and would have preferred that secession not have happened. But he was wrong in the early hours of the crisis, the early months of the crisis, that sentiment would bring these states back into the Union. Their grievances were, and their fears were, much too large and significant for that to happen.
While we're collecting the door prize slips here, if there are any more to be collected, I have a question.
All right.
You referred to the way in which Andrew Jackson handled South Carolina's threat to secede a generation earlier. I'm curious about what you think about the differences in Jackson versus Lincoln in terms of the crises.
For one thing, Jackson had only one state that was in disagreement. The other southern states, though contacted by South Carolina, did not follow its lead in the nullification crisis. It was only the state of South Carolina that nullified the so-called Tariff of Abominations. So Jackson could single out his target and actually threatened South Carolina that he would invade if they didn't retract, if they didn't nullify their nullification. Then he took the very wise course going to Congress and having a force bill passed by Congress, which allowed him to use military force, if necessary, to bring South Carolina around and nullify its nullification. Those were circumstances that Lincoln did not have. For one thing, he wasn't president. For one thing, he couldn't go to Congress and ask for a force bill. For another thing, states kept going out of the Union in fairly rapid succession. We might look at those dates as being separated by weeks sometimes, but mid-19th century purposes, the action of the South and the first seven states to go out was fairly rapid, and I think took Northerners, including Lincoln, completely by surprise.
Yes, when Lincoln called for volunteers, I think it was 75,000 or more. Wasn't this like a terrible blow to the South that they never expected anything like this?
They certainly knew and expected that something would happen once they opened fire on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. And once that happened and shots were fired in anger, then I think the Confederacy, such as it was at that time, fairly knew that this was not going to be a nonviolent protest of Southern states just voluntarily leaving the Union. At that point, they could see in Lincoln some backbone in raising those troops. And of course, Southerners were not very happy with the raising of those troops.
My dad told me this yesterday. He said that in Fort Sumter, the southern states, they shot at Fort Sumter, but did anybody in the Union, did any Union people shoot back?
Yes, they fired back. They weren't as well equipped as the southern batteries that surrounded Charleston Harbor and were all aimed at Fort Sumter. There was a considerable larger degree of shooting by the Southerners than by those Union troops who occupied Fort Sumter. The fort was not even ready. It was under construction, and so all of the artillery had not been put into place yet. So there was firing back, but it wasn't very effective. It was more symbolic, and the surrender was pretty much a foregone conclusion.
While Lincoln was waiting to be inaugurated, there was a president. What did that president do? There was never a word about who was in office doing anything.
James Buchanan, I think, wished that he could be in a, well, he wouldn't know about cartoons. If he could just make a clock go rapidly around and around and around, then his term would be over and he would be out from under it. The man who I rank the lowest among our presidents, he did gain some insight once the first of the year came around, and he attempted to reinforce Fort Sumter. It was a failed attempt, many of the Southerners left his cabinet, and that afforded him an opportunity of bringing Northerners into the cabinet, and he was receiving some very good advice from the new cabinet members who said, James, you're going to have to do something, and you just can't sit with your hands folded any longer. And he got the message, really seriously tried to think his way through, not a whole lot of action, but at least think his way through the secession crisis. But it kept happening in what seems like a long period of time to us, but was rapid for 19th century purposes, was one state going out of the Union after another. And he believed and said publicly that he felt secession was illegal, but then he also said that the president had no power to stop it. Well, okay, then goodbye to the southern states. He said that publicly. So that showed his cards to everyone, and it was probably interpreted by the southern states as an even greater license to secede from the Union.
It sounded like there was a bunch of comments at Abraham Lincoln. They all sounded like bad comments. So how... percentage of how many comments were written, how many of those bad comments do you think were written by Southerners?
Well, there are a lot of bad comments written by Southerners, but the comments that I've quoted tonight were mostly by Northerners and sometimes by members of his own party, because his party was divided over what it should do and how it should respond to the South through this whole winter of crisis. Of a political crisis. With the Republican Party divided and it being a brand new party on the American political scene, it became very difficult for them to gain unity within the party. And I know that I sound hard on Lincoln tonight, but he's one of my heroes. And perhaps I should stress that though I think he faltered to an incredible degree, that historians, because we love Lincoln and Lincoln means so much to the country, have overlooked his faults. That you know, he's grown to be this myth, a mythological figure rather than a historical figure. I think he redeemed himself, is what I'm trying to say. As the 16th President of the United States, not only by simply standing up to the Confederacy and the seceded states, but I think also in his policies of human rights that included ultimately emancipation. And his greatness can't be denied, but I'm suggesting that his road to greatness was a little bit more curvy, a little less targeted than many historians seem to suggest.
There actually was no one, was there, who had a unified, coherent plan to approach this horrible problem? He wasn't by himself.
No, he wasn't by himself by any means. His party was divided. Public opinion in the North was divided. It wasn't until after January, in the beginning of the new year, that public opinion in the North began to solidify as more and more states went out of the Union. Northern attitudes towards secession began to harden. And it was towards secession, more than any issue over slavery, that the North found its own backbone, as it were, and opinions hardened. so that by the time that Lincoln's inaugurated and all the things that he says in his first inaugural address seem to make sense to Northerners, which is we're not going to sit by and let this happen. But by the same token, Lincoln did extend a hand to my dissatisfied countrymen, as he called the Southerners, and hoping for some peaceful resolution. But knowing as the middle of April or the first week of April approached that crisis was at hand and it probably was going to erupt in and around Fort Sumter.
You said Abraham Lincoln was at sea. Does that mean he was like in a boat?
Well, it's a way of describing that he was kind of at a loss. If you're in a boat and you don't have any oars to row that boat, then you're only going to have to ride the waves as they come through. And so to a certain extent, he seemed to be that kind of lost, that he didn't have oars to row his boat. It's called a metaphor. It's just a way of describing the situation that he was in, as I see it, as I interpret it.
Okay. Do we have one final question while I make sure these are mixed up well so the door flies dry? Okay.
And I think the young gentleman there has one more.
One more?
Do you know that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth? Well, the Southerners knew that they weren't going to win the war. Do you think they planned out the assassination, or do you think they did?
I don't think it was an action taken officially by the Confederate government. But it was a conspiracy. It involved a large number of people planning Lincoln's death and attacks on other members of the Union government. But I don't think it was something that the Confederacy had put into action. I think it was the plan of John Wilkes Booth and his fellow conspirators.
Thank you very much for a very insightful and illuminating discussion.